49ers coach Jim Harbaugh not happy with the decisions of tight end Vernon Davis and guard Alex Boone to stay away from the mandatory minicamp. Look, the reality is it's only mandatory if you don't want to give up $70,000 in fines. That's what the collective bargaining agreement allows, and there aren't many ways that players can exert leverage. Players have short careers. Players have limited means to get the attention of the team when the players want new contracts. Now, we could take one side of this and argue that both Vernon Davis and Alex Boone applied their John Hancocks to contracts that commit them to this year and beyond. They should honor those contracts. That's a fair argument. But the other reality is when you play in the NFL and it can all end at any time and the only guaranteed money is the money you get when you sign the contract, everything else is contingent on not getting hit by a bus or not having your knee blown out or not having some other injury that may not be career-ending but necessarily career-limiting, you got to get what you can when you can. Jim Harbaugh is going to get what he can when he can because he's got leverage coming up over the 49ers. He doesn't have to hold out because he doesn't have injury risk. He's got two more years. He could become a coaching free agent. He's going to play the game within the confines of the rules that apply to him. Davis and Boone playing the game within the confines of the rules that apply to them. If they want to give up $70,000 in fines, they don't have to show up at the mandatory minicamp, making it something other than mandatory. And then the question becomes whether or not they'll show up for mandatory training camp. $30,000 a day in fines is what you will lose if you don't show up, making it something other than, you guessed it, mandatory. So it all comes down to how much money these guys are willing to risk in order to get the money that they think they can get by taking a stand. Whether they're right or not remains to be seen. Just like it remains to be seen whether or not Jim Harbaugh is accurate that his stance will result in the contract he wants from the San Francisco 49ers. Ultimately, this is a business. Ultimately, this is about getting the most you can for yourself and for your family. And the people who own the franchises did not get to where they are by not driving the hardest possible bargain whenever and wherever they could. So now the question becomes, especially when you have a limited shelf life to earn that big money, are you going to draw a line? And are you willing to accept the risk that you could lose money, that you could be fined, that you may have to tuck your tail between your legs and come back and play for the contract you don't like, or possibly just retire like Andre Johnson may do in Houston. So I don't know what the 49er way is. I mean, the 49er way is to be excellent in all respects, presumably. Well, in the business respect, Davis and Boone doing what they have to do, doing what they can do under the collective bargaining agreement to get the deals that they think they deserve. And that dovetails nicely with Matthias Kiwanuka's recent comments regarding his regret over the way NFL contracts are. The idea that teams can cut you at any time if they want to. Teams don't get fined for cutting a guy. Teams can do whatever they want. So they come to a guy who doesn't want to leave the team, doesn't want to move, doesn't want to uproot his family, and they say, hey, we're going to pay you less money. Well, what's he going to do? What's he going to do? Say, no, I want you to honor my contract. Well, okay, we'll honor your contract. We'll cut you because there's nothing in our contract that prevents us from cutting you. It is not a two-way street, and that's unfair to the players. But you know what? That's the deal the players have bargained for time and again ever since the NFLPA was founded. There are no fully guaranteed contracts. Now, you can negotiate a fully guaranteed contract like rookies do. The top 10 players, top 20 actually get fully guaranteed contracts. So you can either pay me to play for you or you can pay me to not play for you, but either way, you're going to pay me. You can guarantee that contract. You can get that term if you've got the leverage. Should the contracts be changed to all guaranteed? Well, if that happens, then there'll be less money available in free agency, and you'll have a lot of guys on teams who maybe shouldn't be on teams anymore, and those guys will be taking money that other players who may be better than those guys can't get. See, that's the bottom line here. Regardless of what the contracts say, regardless of how it all works, there are only 1,800 or so jobs available. And if one guy is going to have a job that maybe shouldn't, but he's got a guaranteed contract, that's keeping another guy from getting that job. So I don't think the way contracts are will change. But what players have to recognize is the way this process works, the way you get money in hand, and that is via a signing bonus or a holdout that gets you that new contract, that gets you that guaranteed money, truly guaranteed money, not guaranteed for injury only. And so players do what they have to do. Teams do what they have to do. I don't see the system changing. And I think we would all be a little wiser if we understood that when a player holds out of a mandatory minicamp or holds out of training camp or does something along those lines, it is more of a business gesture than it is some sort of indignity against the logo and the name and everything else that goes with this warped aspect of team, because it only is a team for so far. At a certain point, it's about the individual taking care of himself. And speaking of logos and names, the big news today, which kind of came out of the blue, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has ruled that the Redskins name should be canceled from the perspective of the federal trademark protection, which means if this ultimately is upheld via the inevitable layers of appeals, that anyone and everyone can sell Redskins merchandise, and there isn't a darn thing Daniel Snyder can do about it because he doesn't have that weight of the U.S. government allowing him to send what they call cease and desist letters, to file litigation if necessary, to shut down the people who would set up shop outside of FedEx Field selling Redskins gear. Of course, the great irony here is people would be putting economic pressure on Daniel Snyder to change the name by selling knockoffs that would be legal that perpetuate the slur that is being attacked in the first place. Now, predictably, the team is not panicking, and for good reason. 15 years ago, the exact same ruling was issued by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and ultimately on appeal, the team won. The difference, though, this time around, there is a much more organized effort against the name. And I get the feeling that the tipping point is out there. How much closer does this ruling, regardless of what happens on appeal, push the issue toward the tipping point? Will it cause sponsors to abandon the team? Will it cause Commissioner Roger Goodell to realize, you know what, in 50 years, I don't want my legacy to be that I was asleep at the switch while this name was in a position where it had to change? Will that happen? Will we move forward to the point where the name changes? I believe it's inevitable, right, wrong, or otherwise. It's inevitable it's going to change. The question is when and how. And is there a way that Daniel Snyder can change that name and declare victory and realize a victory financially and otherwise? I don't know that he has the time to do that. The time may be running out, but we'll see how it plays out, both in court and in the court of public opinion, and also, more importantly, from the NFL's perspective, the court of the corporations that spend millions of dollars for the privilege of doing business with the NFL and all of its teams. When we come back, we're going to do a little business with a guy who played at a high enough level to get to the Hall of Fame for the Seattle Seahawks from 1976 through 1989, Steve Largent, joining us now. That's why I have the suit on. This is an interview that we will be using Pro Football Talk on NBCSN as part of the month-long plus a few days Prime Numbers series. Steve Largent wore number 80, retired by the Seahawks. Momentarily unretired at one point, though. We'll talk to him about that coming up. And then we'll talk to you again, as we always seem to do in these slow month editions of PFT Live. We'll take your calls. We'll answer your questions. That's coming up to end the show. Before that, Steve Largent. Before that, we'll take a break. We'll be right back. This is PFT Live. The Prime Numbers series continues all month long on Pro Football Talk. And one of the guys who wore number 80 as well, if not better than anyone else, wore it well enough to get the Seattle Seahawks to retire it, receiver Steve Largent joining us now. And Steve, you wore number 83 at the University of Tulsa well enough to get it retired. Why the switch from 83 to 80 when you came to the NFL?
Well, as you probably recall, Mike, I was drafted by the Houston Oilers in the fourth round. Was actually their second pick. They didn't have a first round. They didn't have a third round pick. Mike Barber was their second round pick. Then I was the fourth round pick. So the second guy on their team to be drafted that year. And I was unceremoniously released or cut or waived by the Oilers after 6 weeks of training camp. And that's when I got a call from Seattle, and they ended up doing what's called a waiver trade. The Oilers recalled me until such point that somebody said, hey, we'd like to have a shot at Largent. They had a couple of teams interested. The Seahawks offered the most, which was an eighth round draft choice, which was not much at that time. And there you go. I'm up to Seattle. So I came into Seattle already being released by one team that summer. So I didn't get to make a lot of decisions about my future, or certainly about my number. So I was just glad to have any number, and they gave me number 80, which was a number of a guy that they had already cut in training camp before I got there. But they gave me number 80, and there's not a lot more story to that. I was 83 in college, and again, I got the number then the same way I got it in the NFL. It was the number they handed to me when I went through the line. So it wasn't a big ceremony, or there's not a big story about it. But it's how most players who played football at that time got their number. Very few guys got to pick the number that they wanted.
You mentioned being with the Houston Oilers for 6 weeks. What number did they issue you when you went to Houston?
That's a good question. I can't even remember. I think it was, I can't even remember. I think it was like a 17 or 18 or something like that, 19 maybe.
Now, in Seattle, Steve Rabel, a name that I had long since forgotten, had arrived that year as a second-round pick as a receiver. He had 83, and you had the much better career. Did you get a little extra motivation from seeing someone else coming in the same rookie class wearing your number? Did that give you any extra kick to have the career that you had?
Well, actually, to add insult to injury, Steve Rabel came from Georgia Tech, where they ran the wishbone. And he was a blocking tight end running the wishbone offense at Georgia Tech. And so he wasn't even a wide receiver until he got to Seattle. But Steve's a great guy. He continues to do the play-by-play for the Seahawks today. He's a news anchor there up in Seattle and a really great guy and a great friend of mine. But, you know, like I said, when I got to Seattle, I was just glad to have a number, glad that they were interested enough in me to trade an eighth-round draft choice to give me a chance. And the real hidden lining in my success at Seattle was that the offensive coordinator, but the quarterback and receiver coach, he did both, was Jerry Rome. And Jerry Rome happened to be my college coach for the 3 years previous to this year. So he had installed our entire passing game into the Seahawks game plan from Tulsa. So I come in the first day and they say, I write 79. I know exactly where to line up, how to run the route, when the ball is going to be thrown. And that's what I did. So it was really that's kind of the secret to my at least making the team in Seattle. I'm not going to say all my success was due to that, but it was largely due to my friendship with Jerry Rome.
And after the move from Houston to Seattle, you stayed with the Seahawks for the rest of your career, something that rarely happens nowadays. And then after your career, a fairly well-known receiver who played with a few teams after the team he was most identified with, the 49ers, Jerry Rice, arrives in Seattle. Your number's retired. Tell us the story how your number came to be unretired so Jerry Rice could wear it.
Well, I ironically, the Seahawks at the time had a general manager or president of the team who had come from the NBA and didn't really know a lot about football, but knew a lot about professional sports. And he called me saying that Jerry Rome wanted to wear number 80, but wanted to ask my permission. And so when Jerry Rice is asking to wear my number, I'm not going to say no. And so I said, sure, that's fine with me. What he did was he called Jerry Rice and said, hey, Steve Largent wants you to wear his jersey when you get to Seattle. And so Jerry said, well, that's fine. I'll wear number 80. I thought it was retired, but I thought it was number 80. But if Steve wants me to wear it, I'll wear it. So he kind of did a double whammy on both Jerry and myself to ensure that Jerry Rice gets number 80 and he can sell a lot of number 80 jerseys or something. But it was kind of a scam on both myself and Jerry Rice.
Well, the Seahawks did a double whammy and then some on the Denver Broncos in the Super Bowl this year, getting the franchise's first NFL championship. What's your thought on whether or not this edition of the Seahawks can continue to compete at a very high level for years to come?
Well, let me tell you I was just in Seattle last weekend and was talking to some guys who had been out to the practices. Jim Zorn, as a matter of fact, I stayed with Jim and talked with him about the practices that they're going through now, the OTAs, as we talked about earlier. And just ask about, you know, what it looked like and how the team was, you know, what kind of shape the team was in, and, you know, whether he felt like they had that hunger in the pit of their stomach to do it again. And he talked about two of the prominent players, one on their offense and one on their defense, almost getting into a fist fight during OTAs because the level of intensity was so high during OTAs. And so I think, you know, for me, that would be something I would look at as to whether this team is going to be prepared to defend their title and get another one next year, is how hungry they are. And I think just by that little demonstration in an OTA, that wasn't even a mini camp, I like that. And I think if they continue that through training camp and through the preseason and then in the first game of the year on September 4th, I think it bodes very well for this team.
Now, you spent the vast majority of your NFL career in Seattle, Washington. You had some time in Washington, D.C. as a member of Congress, and one of the great political issues as it relates to sports nowadays comes from the name of the Washington Redskins. Today, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office found that the trademark protection should be canceled. Any thoughts on how politics fits into this? Any thoughts on whether or not the name should be changed?
Well, let me tell you that first off, the most political issue in the NFL today is about concussions and players that have had concussions and the effect of that. And that's something that I've been following very closely. The NFL and the Redskin, having the Redskin name, you know, that's not really a big deal to me. It doesn't matter to me. But I would tell you, after having worked in this town for almost 20 years, that when it gets into the political circles, there's no telling where it's going to go. Because it can become politically popular to get rid of the name, or it can be politically popular to keep the name. But when politics gets into it, it really is a joker, and you don't know where it's going to fall.
How do you see it then translating to the concussion issue? I get the impression the NFL has done enough, at least for now, to placate the politicians, but could there be a point where politicians get more involved in passing some sort of legislation federally that would impact the sport at every level?
Well, I'm not as concerned about the politics of this or anything like that from the NFL perspective. I'm concerned with the medical impact that it's having on players, particularly players that played in the 80s and the 70s and the 60s and the 50s, and the ill effects that it could be afforded to them. You know, when I played football, we never thought about concussions. It was sort of a red badge of honor that you had a concussion, that you're playing hard and you want to get back in the game. And that's exactly what you did. If you could tell the coach that those are three fingers he's raising up, then you were back in the game. And that happened to me on several occasions in high school and college and in professional athletics. So it wasn't a big deal, and we didn't even think about it. But now we're finding out, as you know, that there could be some dilatory effects from those concussions that can actually alter your lifespan. It can alter the quality of life that you have later in life. And those are things that we never even thought of in the 60s and 70s and 80s when we played football. But now we know, in fact, that they are playing a role. And my feeling is that this is an issue that could actually destroy the NFL. If it's proven that it has this kind of effect on too many players, it could really have a damaging effect on the NFL's reputation and the sport, not just the NFL, but the sport of football. So that's my concern. I hope that it doesn't go down that road. I hope that the science shows us that it's you can still play football in a safe manner the majority of the time, and that we can continue with the sport, because I don't think the NFL's ever had a better moment, a shining moment in the sun than they have right now. And I don't think they've ever made more money than they're making right now. And I think that's all good for players, it's good for the owners, it's good for everybody related to the NFL. So I want to see that game continue to prosper and grow. But I do think this issue of concussions is one you got to keep your eye on, because if they don't, it would really have a negative effect on the entire league, if the entire league can even survive.
And mechanically, I'm very curious as to how you see that falling, if it would happen that the NFL would have serious long-term consequences, possibly go away altogether. Would it be because the supply of players disappears because people quit playing at lower levels? Would it be that at some point we realize there's no safe way to play football and football just needs to be made illegal? How do you see it potentially happening?
You know, I think either one of those roads it could go down very easily. And, you know, I think that even today we're beginning to see decreasing numbers of players participating in football. I talk to parents all the time about whether they're going to let their son play football in junior high or high school. And more parents I talk to now are saying, no, I'm not going to let him play. Maybe I'll let him play later on, but he's not going to play before junior high, and he's not going to play junior high. Maybe I'll let him play in high school. And even there's not very many parents that I've talked to that are going to let their kid play in high school. So I think that has long-term dilatory effect on the entire league and the quality of the players that are coming out.
if you had to do it all over again, young Steve Large in high school, knowing what you know now?
I would do it again in a heartbeat. I love the game. And I had a series of concussions. I probably had more than six concussions over my high school, college, and professional career. But I really love the game, and I love competing. I love the teammates that I played with. And there's really nothing like it.
Well, hopefully we can do this again at some point. Great discussion. Great to visit with you. Congratulations again on all your success, both on the field and off the field. And we look forward to talking to you down the road.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
All right, there he is. Hall of Famer Steve Largent, one of the best ever to wear number 80. Great story on how it kind of like, I feel like it's what my kid does to me and my wife. You know, well, mom said I can do it, and then mom hears dad said I could do it, and the next thing you know, the kid gets to do something that neither of us would have allowed him to do. What we're going to do now, and I don't have to ask permission for this. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to ask you to ask us questions that you ask me to answer, and I'll do my best to try to answer them. We'll do that after the break. This is PFT Live. It's PFT Planet Time, boys and girls, children of all ages, answering your questions as submitted via the Twitter and via the cell phone device. We'll start off, as we always do in this segment, with a question from @BruinsGirl33. With Jimmy Garoppolo doing well in training camp, do you see him as Brady's backup this season? Well, that's a good question, because we really don't know what they think about Ryan Mallett, who's entering the final year of his rookie contract. Are they going to keep three quarterbacks on the roster? They don't usually do that in New England. Are they going to keep Mallett in the hopes that someone calls up and says, we'll trade something for Ryan Mallett? Well, they'd hold him all the way until the trade deadline to see if there's an injury or some other circumstance that compels a team to call for Ryan Mallett. Just yesterday, new Texans coach Bill O'Brien named Ryan Fitzpatrick as starting quarterback, the same Ryan Fitzpatrick to whom the Titans didn't want to pay $3.25 million this year to be part of their depth chart. $3.25 million, as quarterbacks go, not much money. For now, he's number one in Houston. What if he struggles in training camp? Could Ryan Mallett be an option then? There was some buzz before the draft that maybe a trade would happen. I think if Garoppolo shows that he has the poise, that he has the skill, that he has the smarts to run that offense if they would need him to play this year, then you're in a position where you could flip Ryan Mallett for something of value. Now, if he leaves as a free agent after the season, it goes into that complicated formula for compensatory draft picks in 2016. If they could get something for Mallett for 2015 or a player that maybe they need, then that's a possibility. So I don't read much into what happens in OTAs, just like pro days, but they believed in this guy enough to make him a second-round pick at a time when maybe they could have taken tight end C.J. Fedorowicz or someone else who would help Tom Brady win another Super Bowl or two before he retires. To the phone lines, Isle, you're on PFT Live. What's up, Isle?
Hello.
Hello.
With the Browns waiving Earl Bennett and the possible suspension that Josh Gordon is going to be getting anytime soon, who do you see the Browns getting at wide receiver? Because Miles Austin certainly isn't enough.
Well, the good news is, and thank you for the call, they haven't cut Miles Austin already. They've cut Earl Bennett. Of course, they could cut Miles Austin at any time. I think they're going to hope that the guys on the roster step up. GM Ray Farmer has already come out and said you don't need to have a game-breaking receiver to be successful in the NFL. How many teams have won Super Bowls with high-end game-breaking receivers? We saw the Patriots get there with Randy Moss in 2007. We saw the Eagles get there with Terrell Owens in 2004. Both teams lost that year in the Super Bowl. Now, Josh Gordon can be a game-breaking receiver if he's available, but I think what's more likely to happen, Ray Farmer and company going to watch and see who gets cut by these other teams as we get deeper into training camp. The problem is very hard to make an impact right away with a new team if you come over and you're getting up to speed with new personnel, new offense, new system, new terminology. I'd keep an eye on Santana Moss. There's some thought that maybe the presence of DeSean Jackson, the way it bumps down that depth chart, could bump Santana Moss off the roster. He'd be a perfect guy to come in and play in Cleveland because he knows Kyle Shanahan's system based on their time together in Washington. Back to the Twitter bag. Question from @YoungBR2002. When is a realistic time frame for Justin Blackmon's possible reinstatement? Just prior to training camp. That is wishful thinking. I am told that the Jacksonville Jaguars expect the suspended receiver to be reinstated at some point this season, but not in time for week one. And the Jaguars remain committed to Justin Blackmon, if for no reason other than to give this kid hope. This is one of the great dichotomies in the NFL. There's no indication that Colts owner Jim Irsay has been thrust into that same mechanism that will compel a guy to continuously pass drug tests and threaten him with being banished from the NFL for an extended period of time if he fails, even if he has an addiction. Justin Blackmon, who is banished from the NFL until he's reinstated by the league office, has some hope, has a reason to stay clean every day, a way to help him overcome his issues off the field by knowing that a job is available for him when he is reinstated. Of course, it helps that he's pretty darn good when he plays. And the Jaguars haven't seen him much over the past couple of seasons, but when they see him, he plays extremely well. They're holding a spot for him in the hopes he can get back. They don't expect him to be back by week one. He could be back at some point during the 2014 season. Another Twitter question from Miami Sports Addict. Where do you rank the Dolphins' offensive line as you see it right now with the new players acquired? Well, look, Mike Pouncey, one of the best centers in the NFL, despite whatever is up with that dude, and I don't know what's up with that dude, but he's different from Marquise in that, you know, very unapologetic, almost delusional about how these off-field issues affect his perception. Brandon Albert, a guy they tried to get last year, couldn't get him. They brought him in. He gets banged up from time to time. I still don't see five across a unit that will perform dramatically better than it did last year. I know Juwan Thomas, right tackle, but what are the guards? How do we feel about the guards? And when you have creative packages and pressure coming from all sorts of different angles, look, will they give up 53 or 56 sacks? It was something north of 50 last year. It was not good. They have to rein that in, and they should do better. I don't know how much better they will be this year. And middle of the pack at best right now for this offensive line, but leaning toward the bottom until we see what these new acquisitions can do. G. Williams in Long Beach, California. Welcome to PFT Live.
Thank you, sir. My question was, with the Washington Redskins losing their patents, one, will this force them to change their team name? And then two, how long will the process take?
Well, that's a great question, because this same ruling was issued by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office in 1999. The team eventually won on appeal, and a statement that has been issued by the team via its trademark and patent attorney points out, hey, we've been down this road before. We've lost at this level before, and we ultimately won, and we believe the cases are no different. The last one and this one, we believe we're going to win again when we appeal it. And the difference, as I see it this time around, the public debate over the propriety of the name now is light years ahead of what it was in 1999. It wasn't even on anyone's radar screen in 1999. For whatever reason, it is now a viable debate, and it's been made viable by the team's misguided PR decision in 2013 to join the issue, to start pointing out all the high schools that use that name, to start raising the argument, well, why do politicians care about it, and why was it okay for 70 years? And it's not a slur, it's a badge of honor. And the arguments come one after another. And the all caps never comment from Daniel Snyder. It has caused the opposition to coalesce and gain momentum. So now, I mean, look around the internet. It's the top story out there, because this legal ruling, even though no different than the one that we saw in 1999, it comes at a time when the opposition to the name is looking for something to validate the opposition. And you don't get much more validation than a ruling from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, that the name is so offensive that it should no longer be protected by federal law. That is significant from the perspective of getting people to oppose the name who are currently on the fence, and those who oppose the name to get more creative in the ways they go about attacking it. What's next? Do we have a tweeter question? How about a Twitter question from Trajan Adoy? I can't believe I got that right on the first try after saying Twitter. If the playoffs are expanded, do you expect more upsets in the first rounds? Do you see an eighth seed beating a first seed? Well, I can predict with certainty that if the current proposal to expand the playoffs goes through, there will never be an eighth seed that beats a one seed. And I can say that with certainty, because the current proposal would only add a seventh seed in each conference. So the way it would work, from 12 to 14, you'd have seven teams. The first week, the first seed gets the bye. Two plays seven, three plays six, four plays five. And then the lowest remaining team plays one, and that team has the week off, and we'll see whether or not that makes a difference. Now, A lot of people look at it and say, well, the second seed plays the seventh seed. It'll just be a blowout. Well, maybe not. This year, it would have been the Cardinals going to Carolina. The Cardinals blew out the Panthers when they played in the regular season. And it would have been the Steelers going to New England. Now, the Patriots blew out the Steelers during the regular season, but who knows? And that's the thing about the NFL. Back in the 70s, it was a lot easier to pick winners in these games. Nowadays, the talent gap from the best team to the worst team, more narrow than ever. And yeah, I think there will be upsets, 2 seed, 7 seed, but not 1 seed, 8 seed, unless and until 16 teams get into the postseason, which I doubt would happen without expansion. And the NFL does not seem to be inclined to expand. And the strongest argument against expansion, look at all the quarterbacks out there now. There aren't enough good quarterbacks for 32 teams. Do not consider 34 teams or 36 teams or anything more than 32 because there just aren't the quarterbacks to go around. One more question to go around before we call it a day. Twitter question courtesy of at MRRAMIA. Boy, I did so much better with the last one. How much better can the Eagles be after a whole offseason together? Hey, they can be a lot better. Last year, there were no expectations for this Eagles team. No one knew what to expect. Chip Kelly coming to the NFL after having no experience in professional football at any level, at any time. Wasn't a player, wasn't a coach, wasn't an assistant, wasn't a water boy, didn't work the chain gang, didn't do anything. This is a guy who made his bones in college football, brought his ways to the NFL. I was very skeptical. I'm not going to be one of those guys who had opinions last year or any prior year that ended up being wrong and act like I never had them. I was very skeptical about Chip Kelly, and my attitude was, you got to prove it to me that you can get it done at this level. He did. And now, with these smoothies and the training techniques and the very limited number of guys who were lost for the season due to injury and the gap seemingly getting bigger in the NFC East. The only thing that kind of pushed the needle the other way was the decision to give up on DeSean Jackson and his decision to sign in Washington. Yeah, I think with a whole offseason together and with Nick Foles as the unquestioned starter in offseason workouts and training camp, not sharing those precious reps with the first team, with Michael Vick, wow. Nick Foles could be a lot better. The Eagles could be a lot better. The franchise could lift even higher, and who knows, maybe they'll go higher than they ever have gone. They've been to the Super Bowl a couple of times, never won it. Boy, you get the feeling under Chip Kelly that at some point they're going to figure it out, especially if they can keep their guys healthy on a consistent basis, because that's the key. When you look at the teams that make it to the Super Bowl and win it, and you look at the number of players they put on injured reserve, you've got good players who stay healthy. You don't have to use that depth that you have on the roster because the guys that you have are able to play week in and week out. Sooner or later, you're going to knock on the door every year. You're going to kick it in eventually. We're going to kick in the broadcast. That's it. Great addition today, not due to my involvement. It was great to have Steve Largent on the program. Great story about how he and Jerry Rice got played against each other for number 80 in Seattle after it had been retired for Largent. Great questions from you, as always. We appreciate that. Check us out tonight, 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time, NBCSN. Interview with Curtis Martin, who wore number 28. That's one of the prime numbers. Donovan McNabb joins the program. He wore number 5. We've got 5 or 6 prime numbers tonight. And feel free to use those numbers for your lottery tickets. I mean, you know, it can't hurt, right? The odds are already pretty long as it is, but somewhat greater chance that I'm going to shut up so you can get back to what you're doing, which hopefully will be checking us out at profootballtalk.com. See you tonight, 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. See you tomorrow at 12 noon. Have a good one.